I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, in today's world of temptation and overabundance, the practice of self-discipline, an idea praised by ancient Stoic philosophers Marcus Aurelius, Cicero, and Seneca, may have newfound meaning.
I see self-discipline as a cornerstone of what the Stoics thought was not just our sort of duty and responsibility as human beings, but also in the pursuit of the good life. I don't think there is such a thing as the good life, no matter how much we might fantasize about it, without self-discipline.
And later, the science of habits, from sticking with new practices to unlearning the bad ones.
You can put frictions in place that force you to pause and think for a moment before you just mindlessly engage in a behavior, and that gives you at least an opportunity for the thinking part of your mind instead of the automatic part of your mind to decide, is this what I want to be doing right now?
The power of self-discipline with Ryan Holiday and the making of a habit. That's coming up on Life Examined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. The ability to master anything in life is a challenge. But when it comes to living a good life, it's the practice of self-discipline and moderation that can be easily overlooked. After all, being disciplined is to be predictable, something that many of us shy away from. I mean, it sounds kind of boring, right? But in his latest book, Discipline is Destiny, Ryan Holiday takes a closer look at what it means to be disciplined. Drawing on ancient Stoic philosophy, temperance and self-discipline is to demand the best of oneself, even when no one is looking. In his new book, Holiday looks to more recent history to provide some interesting and surprising examples, from Toni Morrison and Hemingway to Queen Elizabeth II, to show that an effective use of time and keeping a routine, being extremely disciplined can lead to satisfaction and joy. Ryan Holiday is a speaker, writer, and host of the Daily Stoic podcast. He's the author of numerous books, and the latest is called Discipline is Destiny, The Power of Self-Control, and he joins me now. Ryan Holiday, great to have you back on Life Examined. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So talk about how this idea of discipline fits into Stoic philosophy or the different Stoic ideals. I know you go beyond that in this book, but we turn to you for all things Stoic. So I'm curious how you see it fitting into the framework.
Well, the Stoics had four cardinal virtues. They actually happen to be the same as the cardinal virtues of Christianity, but these four virtues are courage, temperance or self-discipline, justice, and wisdom. So I see self-discipline as a cornerstone, one of the sort of key pillars of what the Stoics thought was not just our sort of duty and responsibility as human beings, but also in the pursuit of the good life. I don't think there is such a thing as the good life, no matter how much we might fantasize about it, without self-discipline. No one is more miserable than the person who does what they want, whenever they want it, without limitation, without checks and balances. That's a recipe for ruin and misery.
It's interesting. What you just described is actually maybe what most people would say they want in this world. So maybe you can say more about that.
Well, if you look at the modern world, it has been a steady march. Obviously, there are some exceptions here, but a steady march where we have more freedom, more opportunity, more abundance than our ancestors could have ever conceived. Right? You take Marcus Aurelius, the emperor of Rome, immense fortune, immense power, immense access, and just the ordinary things that we have access to, the ease at which we can do things, we can change, we can go places. This would have been inconceivable to them. And I would hardly argue that we're, happier or better as a result of it, just universally so, because what's required from all of this abundance and freedom and is as they would say, sort of it necessitates a self-discipline. Because we can do whatever we want, we have to decide, what we're willing to do and not willing to do. Or again, I think, that is a perilous road. Was it Oscar Wilde who said, the two tragedies in life are not getting everything you want and getting everything that you want? Mm. When you get everything that you want, when suddenly you are powerful or successful or important or well off, the things that you couldn't do before, you can do now, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea to do them.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think this is this really strange conundrum we've hit in the modern world, which is that choice is everywhere, from trying to pick out, you know, your cereal box at the grocery store to picking a career. And I mean, this is, you know, assuming you have some level of privilege and access to some financial resources. But it just is
true. Think about a dating app.
Sure.
Right? Like, you have access to an unlimited amount of potential people that you could be with. Yeah. And that the fact that there is a tangible sort of real, amount of other fish in the sea, it makes it hard for some people to stay in relationships. It makes it hard for them to, I don't want to say settle because it sounds like the wrong idea, but it makes it hard for them to make a choice, yeah. Right? We are overwhelmed by choice and opportunity and distraction. And that makes it hard to sort of be in the moment or to find what is actually the right thing for you.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that you see this a lot in relationships, or when somebody's thinking about big life questions like career, there's always now this looming thought of maybe something would just be a little bit easier. The person I could be with would be a little bit better. The career that I didn't choose could be a little bit more fulfilling. And you could just get lost in this in perpetuity.
I think that's right, and I think a lot of people do. The unlimitedness of it all becomes not a gift, but a curse.
So, talk to me a little bit about just this virtue of discipline, and how you understand the word after probably looking at it through a number of examples in the book.
The line from the Stoics, who were often either in positions of power or advisors to those who were in power, they said, "No one is fit to rule who has not first mastered themselves." And so I love thinking of discipline in that sense. Seneca called it the greatest empire, right? To be in command of yourself. And I think the reason he was saying this is, again, having seen very powerful, successful, wealthy people up close, he saw that actually that wasn't all that rare, that there were lots of people who were in charge of armies or, you know, had an enormous estate. But he said, you know, of these men, and they were mostly men, obviously, he said, "Show me one who isn't a slave," right? He said, "One man is a slave to his mistress, the other to ambition, the other to what other people think about them." He says, even the slave owners are slaves to their slaves. And I think this is a really key way of thinking and looking about it, because so often from a distance, we admire, you know, a person of influence, a person of power, a person of fame. But when we actually look at their lives up close, we realize that it wasn't a very free life, because they're not in control. They had mastered the piano or mastered, you know, the ballot box. Whatever their specific domain was, they had conquered it. The thing that they were not in charge of was their ambition, was, you know, their need to be validated, was their appetites. And I think what the virtue of self-discipline is about setting our sights on this more elusive, rarer kind of mastery.
How does one do that? Maybe you can give now some examples of it and talk about, you know, whether it's something we're gifted, whether it's a practice. I'd love to hear more.
Well, I definitely think it is a practice. I'll give you an example from my own life. Obviously, I'm an ambitious, driven person. I try to compete inside my profession at the highest level. I write books. I try to do my best on these books. But I try to think about, going back to a very Stoic practice, you know, am I rooting my goals and efforts towards things that I control? Or am I rooting my goals and efforts towards things that other people control, right? Am I trying to write the best book that I'm capable of writing? Or am I trying to write a book that is received well by fancy people who celebrate me and invite me to their parties, right? And it takes more discipline to say, hey, I'm not going to aim at the thing that might be more fun, that might be more socially acceptable, that might be a more all-consuming, you know, sort of thing to chase. I'm going to focus on this humbler, more internal, less quantifiable thing, which is, you know, am I realizing my own potential? And then sort of even within that, you know, am I going to let this thing that is important to me, that I'm well compensated for, am I going to let that consume and take over my life? Or do I have the self-discipline to put boundaries around that and say, here, this is what time I come home from the office every day, right? This is how often I am gone on business trips, right? This is how present I am able to be in the middle of a writing project. So, you know, discipline isn't just like, hey, what time do you get out of bed in the morning? Or, you know, do you follow this diet or that diet? Discipline is also sort of reining in these urges or drives that, you know, may well be societally accepted or validated urges.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's also something else going on here that I'd love to explore, which is that it's not just a matter of discipline, but one needs to know, what are they being disciplined for? What is the value you're aiming towards? What is the greater good? Which is not the discipline itself. It's to be a good person, a good father, a good writer. I mean, so there needs to be something in which, you know, we're moving towards by developing this kind of practice.
It's funny you point that out, because Marx really specifically catches himself in Meditations in that exact regard. He goes, look, you're trying to be a better wrestler, a better speaker, you know, a better this, a better that. He's like, but not a better person. He says, not a better forgiver of faults, not a better friend in tight places. And, you know, it's often easier and clearer to get better at, you know, how fast you run a mile, or whether you have six-pack abs, or, you know, whether your stock portfolio grew this year. Those are things that require discipline, and these are things that, you know, not enough people are as skilled at as they could be. But if those things come at the expense of improvements or discipline in, you know, do you lose your temper at people that you love, right? Do you sort of selfishly pursue your own interests at the expense of, you know, the common good? Or, you know, it's harder to be a good man than a great man, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah, and maybe we can bring in some more examples here. And there's a bunch of interesting ones. I mean, you wrote extensively about Queen Elizabeth, who recently died, and as somebody that exhibited quite a bit of discipline.
I mean, her job is basically discipline, if you think about it. You know, the list of the things that the Queen can do is much shorter than the list of things the Queen is not permitted to do. And yes, obviously she has an enormous inherited fortune of questionable colonial origins, and we can get into all of these sort of questions about the legitimacy of the monarchy. But I think if you really zoom in and you think about what it would be like to have a job where essentially all of the decisions of the government are made, you know, ostensibly in your name, and yet you have no ability to voice your opinion on these things. Mm-hmm. You have no power to direct or shape them. You have to exist not solely as a figurehead. That is to miss what the actual art of her profession is. But you have to be remarkably restrained, and you have to wear the mask of ceremony. And the work that you do has to be, you know, primarily indirect. You know, primarily sort of it's a long-term thing. And it was a 7-decade career for which there were, you know, truly no off days, defined almost entirely by poise and restraint and, you know, self-withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, you know, none of this sounds like a very fun life, we would say, or one that seems particularly appealing. So I'm wondering why you thought this was kind of an important example to point to.
You know, it's actually funny. I from what I've read, she also loved the job, right? She loved meeting people. She loved ceremony. She was deeply committed to the, we talked about earlier, having sort of a North Star, being a force for positive good in the world. As the British Empire waned and it became replaced with this idea of the Commonwealth of Nations, of which she was the head, I think, you know, you could argue that she had the most fun of any monarch, not in the debauched sort of gluttonous sense that some of her predecessors and relatives have, but as a person who had a clear sense of purpose, a clear sense of what her job was, and a desire to wake up every single day and do it. I mean, I loved the anecdote that she fell asleep once on the job in 70 years.
Wow.
And that was at a lecture about magnets when she was like 85 years old. You know, she found ways to make the job really interesting. You know, she was a remarkable observer of people and things. She would notice things that her staff and her security would never see. She was always there with a quip or a joke. It took a lot out of her, as I think all, you know, sort of true greats at their professions, you know, can attest. But I also think there was an immense amount of satisfaction and pride that comes from a job well done.
Mm-hmm. And when you frame it, I think, as one waking up with a purpose and a structure and a reason to complete duties, I mean, I think that's something that a lot of us crave, and that's something that I think a lot of us are missing in just modern life, in which, you know, we can just follow the winds of culture to whatever direction they may blow.
Yeah, the Stoics would say that's what we're here for, right? That we each have a contribution to make, and that by not making that contribution, we hurt not just ourselves, but the hive. And that by making that contribution, we help not just the hive, but ourselves. And so, you know, sort of figuring out what that thing is for you and then committing yourself to it, that's everything. Marcus Aurelius says, love the discipline you know and let it support you. And I think he means discipline in both senses. He means it not just the, you know, this is my routine, this is my structure, this is what the job demands, but the discipline of philosophy for him, the discipline of leadership for him. You know, figure out what that thing is and give yourself over to it. And there's a passage in Meditations where he talks about, you know, struggling to get out of bed in the morning. And he says, but it's so warm here under the covers. And he goes, but wait, you weren't put here to huddle under the blankets and be warm. He says, you know, you should go and do what your nature demands. And he says, people who love what they do will wear themselves down doing it. He says they'll forget even to sleep and eat. And, you know, when I'm really in the midst of a project that's challenging me and fulfilling me and I feel like is important, I mean, that's just one of the most wonderful feelings in the world.
Yeah, and we know this from psychology that, you know, whatever those activities are, whatever the flow states you can be brought into, those are the places that we're going to eventually find a lot of gratitude and happiness day by day.
And I think do good, important work, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody resentfully does peak performance, right? Mm-hmm. Like it comes from really locking in and loving it.
There's a bunch of other interesting examples I'd love for you to get to, too. For example, you talk about another writer here. This is Toni Morrison. How does she fit into the conversation of discipline?
Well, Toni Morrison, I think, is a very inspiring example to all of us writers or parents. You know, when she sits down to write her first novel, she has a full-time day job. She's an editor at Random House, and she's just recently become a single mother of two young boys. Mm. And she finds that, you know, to make contact, as she says, with the muses, she has to be watching the sun come up. And more importantly, she can only write before she's heard the word mom in the morning. And so for her, it becomes this sort of ritual of waking up very early, attacking the day, attacking the page in front of her. You know, Hemingway himself would famously speak about sort of waking up early when it's cold and then warming yourself as you write by the writing. And I think that was her routine and the insight that she came, which is like, you can't leave this thing, the craft or the task that you're meant to do, you can't leave that for the afternoon after you've done all the other stuff. It can't be an afterthought. It's got to be the main thing.
Mm.
You got to tackle it first.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that always surprises me about successful people and stories like Toni Morrison is that I think a lot of us complain that we don't have enough time. But why is it that the people that seem to produce the most are extremely busy as well? They're not exactly just sitting around, you know, with trust funds with nothing else going on. There's something about finding time or being in the flow of time that seems to be really productive.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's got the same 24 hours, right? It's sometimes a fantasy. We think, oh, they just have more time. It's easier for them. In fact, it's harder for them. They've got, you know, additional responsibilities. The opportunity costs are higher for them to stay focused, to be disciplined about what they say yes or no to. But I will say that you find that high performers have to be disciplined about the systems and structures and organizations that they build around themselves. I tell a story that I was quite inspired by in the book about Harry Belafonte talking to Coretta Scott King. He's called to sort of check in on the family during the civil rights movement. And as they're on the phone, you know, she's having to put the phone down to put dinner in the oven. She's having to put the phone down because there's a crying kid that needs her. She's just running around like many of us do, is sort of crazy and chaotically. And he says, you know, excuse me, Coretta, but do you have any help? And she goes, oh, no, of course not. Martin would never permit such a thing. Mm-hmm. And it was true. Martin Luther King Jr. Was reluctant to have staff or help because he was a minister and he was, you know, committed to this this nonprofit cause, this organization. And it felt, you know, sort of entitled or irresponsible to be spending that money to, you know, have a chauffeur or a maid or a cook. But he was also missing the point, right? And as Harry Belafonte would say, you know, that ends right now. He said, I will be paying for you to have a household staff so you can focus on what's actually important, which is the civil rights movement. And this idea of, you know, if you're really driven, if you're really disciplined, if you're really good at what you do, you don't like to delegate. You're often a micromanager. And that is not a way to scale what you do. That is not a way to grow at what you do. And so it can require discipline to say, hey, I can't do insert thing anymore, whether that's mowing your own lawn or not having childcare or whatever it is. You have to figure out a way to be disciplined. These are often hard decisions so that you have carved out the space and time to do the thing that only you can do.
Yeah. I know you've thought a lot about how you've been productive or how others have, how they have found a way to stay disciplined. And just, I'm curious for any practical tips. I mean, waking up early, for example, or making lists, I don't know, or exercise. Sure. What do you find has been kind of successful or works?
I think all of that's a part of it. I mean, for me, my morning routine is centered around one, getting up early, two, not touching my phone or devices immediately after waking up. I like to leave a buffer of 30 minutes or an hour at least so I can be present. I can think about the day. I can see my kids in the morning. We usually go for a long walk outside before I sort of go into what I have to do for the day. That way I know, again, it's a statement of priorities, that however the work goes, I also did my other most important job, and I did it early. I'm not leaving it until the afternoon or the evening when I'm tired and they're tired and all of that. So I go for this walk, I do a little journaling, and then my rule is I try to tackle the hard thing first, which is almost always writing. And so, you know, by 10 or 11 o'clock, I've had a successful day. There's still more to do and more that I want to do, but I've crossed off a lot of the big items from the to-do list before, you know, before noon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're kind of already off and running. And I've seen you do kind of post lists of other interesting things, like don't use voicemail. And I don't know, you have these other kind of interesting little tips you've provided to people.
Yeah, I try to limit the amount of things that can come to me, right? I try to, again, the phone is usually the enemy in a lot of ways. I don't try to get sucked into different rabbit holes. I like to listen to music, usually like one song on repeat as I'm writing. I'll pick a song and I'll sort of get into a vibe or a zone. You know, you try to limit interruptions. You try to cultivate an environment that's conducive to you, you know, being in the right headspace. So yeah, I'm always looking for tips and tricks. But I think you talked a little bit about, you know, how do they have the time? The answer is ultimately like nobody gives you the time. You have to make the time and the space. Mm.
It's interesting that you started this conversation talking about the virtues of courage, temperance, justice, and wisdom, and how those actually also align with different Christian virtues as well, or the same ones. And what's interesting is when we think, though, about maybe putting some of this stuff in a more religious context, especially a Christian one, is that, you know, I would use the word ascetic. That can come up. One that actually a person will refuse all pleasure or bodily pleasure, sure, or will begin to think that life should only be about almost a monastic way of living and maybe a militaristic sense of a schedule every day. So maybe you can address that as well, because it does seem to be where some of this could go.
Yeah, look, I think part of the reason you see the Stoics write so strongly about these topics is that they were successful, they were ambitious, they were talented. And it wasn't as if they were, you know, in a monastery whipping themselves. Mm. They were celebrated playwrights, or they were emperors, or they were businessmen and women. And they needed sort of reminders about what was important, about what it took, about, you know, I think they were talking about some of these ideas often as a counterbalance to very natural impulses or tendencies that we all have. So, you know, Marcus Aurelius doesn't write about laughing at jokes or how sex feels good or food tastes good. I think he's trying to remind himself not to get carried away by those things, which does come back to the idea of temperance or moderation. It's about balance. So, you know, the Stoics don't say anywhere like, hey, never drink alcohol. They just point out that it might feel good on the way down, but if you do it to such excess that you have a hangover the next day, how pleasurable was that actually?
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how you would reflect on this, because I know that people can read Stoicism through different lenses or see it through different lenses. And I know that you've probably been approached by people that take a more militaristic view of it.
Sure.
And I wonder how you would respond to that, because I know it's out there.
Yeah, look, I think just as every philosophy and every religion has its fundamentalists, you know, its literalists, it has its pickers and choosers. You know, I think I'm somewhere in the middle. When I look at the Stoics, I see people who wrote very beautiful and clear philosophical ideas. And then when I look at the lives of those same Stoics, I see them struggle as human beings to put that into practice. And so I see it as this ideal that we are aspiring to get towards, but I also understand, you know, that we're human beings. Mm-hmm. And that there's a famous moment in Marcus Aurelius's life where he loses a tutor that he had loved quite deeply. And, you know, he's sort of grieving and crying. And one of the Stoic philosophers goes to sort of admonish him that, you know, this is not what Stoicism is. And his stepfather, Antoninus, who Marcus really sort of reveres above all others, says, no, let the boy be human. And he says, neither philosophy nor empire takes away human feeling. And so I try to remind myself that the Stoics were not these sort of superhumans. They were not religious zealots, but they were real people in the real world trying to be as disciplined as possible within, you know, even the ideas of that we have to be, you know, enjoy even moderation in moderation, or that we have to be disciplined about our discipline.
Yeah, no, that's huge. And I mean, to me, this is all really fundamental philosophical or religious stuff. I mean, you could go back to these early ideals of Apollo and Dionysus, right? Dionysus being the kind of the god of wine and passions and parties, and Apollo being, you know, the god of form and more of temperance. So these kind of different archetypes have been with us, I think, for a really long time, and the difficulty in navigating them, don't you think?
I do. And there would have been, you know, just as there were the Catos of the world who seemed to be so strict with themselves as to be without, joy. You know, the expression in Rome was, we can't all be Catos. There were also the cautionary tales. There were the drunks, and there were the addicts, and there were the insatiable, you know, insatiable pleasure addicts or money addicts or whatever it was. And the Stoics sort of looked at both, right, and tried to strike a balance. They tried to be philosophical as well as, you know, sort of pragmatic people involved in the world. And I think we're, you know, each of us tries to navigate that in our own way down to today, because as different as the world is, you know, the act of sitting down to a buffet dinner remains unchanged, right? The temptations there remain unchanged. And there's this great line from Epictetus that says, like, try to live life as though you're at a banquet. You know, you can't keep it all to yourself. You know, you can't eat without limit. You try to take your helping and, you know, pass the plate along. And you know, so even there, they were talking about, they had the same kind of self-talk that you and I might have as we sit down to Thanksgiving in a couple months.
Yeah. I also like the fact that you brought up this idea that sometimes we can't be too disciplined in our discipline, or we have to, or we have to also be aware of when we think we're being disciplined, when it may not even be helpful. I mean, you know, we think of, say, I don't know, we could use the word like the virtue of exercise or something that we deem to be a good, healthy activity, but one can be too disciplined in that. Anything can become almost an unhealthy habit when it's taken to a certain extreme. I'm sure that's something you've seen quite a bit as well.
I mean, I deal with that myself all the time. I'm someone who I love to run every day or do some form of strenuous exercise. But like, if I'm not feeling well, it can often be more difficult for me to take a rest day than to just stick with what I'd like to do, right? And yet, what's ultimately the healthier, more responsible thing to do, right? It's not like I'm choosing between going for a run and, you know, gorging myself on the couch. I'm choosing between different kinds of self-care. And, you know, discipline is not just whipping yourself. It's not just pushing yourself. It's, as Seneca says, it's also learning how to be a good friend to yourself, which means taking care of yourself, knowing your limits, you know, knowing your boundaries and respecting those.
Mm-hmm. Well, for anybody that's listening here and is just thinking, you know, I myself would like to try and just be a little bit more disciplined, is there any place that you would suggest that they start, or just some easy kind of launching pads for them?
I do think, like, what time do you wake up, and what is your relationship with, like, your devices or technology the second you wake up, right? Like, if you're sucked into social media before your feet hit the floor, you have already seeded a certain amount of discipline before the day has even begun, right? And so I might start there with just, you know, being a little more intentional about how you begin the day. And I think if you can kind of own the morning, you know, you can really have a better chance of conquering the day.
Mm. And I also really like that phrase you said, kind of learning to be a good friend to yourself, which I think is one of also kindness and empathy.
Yeah, and that it's a process, right? It's not you magically transform yourself. It's that, you know, are you getting a little bit better each day? Are you making a positive contribution each day? More often than not, are you doing the disciplined thing? Zeno would say that well-being is realized by small steps, but it's no small thing. And I think that's a wonderful encapsulation of the power of making disciplined decisions, you know, moment to moment, day by day.
My guest has been Ryan Holiday. He's the author of the new book, Discipline is Destiny, The Power of Self-Control. And we've been lucky to have him on the show a number of times talking about Stoic philosophy and many other things. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, the power of creating good habits. But before we get to that, we'd love to hear from you. Do you have any ideas or tips when it comes to self-discipline? Are there things that work for you? A good morning routine like Ryan Holiday was suggesting, a good cup of coffee, maybe lists, anything else come to mind? Join us and write on our Facebook page. You can find it at kcrw.com/lifeexamined or by searching in Facebook for KCRW Life Examined. We'd love to keep growing the community and spreading the conversation. We'll be back after this short break.